These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
The evidence is gone, but the nightmare continues. Welcome to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis.
Richard Allen's fate hanging in the balance as we're recording this piece right now. He's accused, of course, being of the Delphi murderer category. We'll see if a jury believes that, as that is where it's sitting right now in their hands. They may already have the verdict by the time you're watching this. Joining me to discuss the case itself and how it's all played out up until its final moments, Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor. Let's just kind of do the overview. Both sides have had a chance to now close their arguments, give it over to the jury. Let's start out here by talking about the prosecution of Mr. Richard Allen in this case, from what we knew before going into court to what we know now. How is it read out to you?
It's a bit lackluster to me, especially when you consider some of the bluster pretrial where they're talking about, oh gosh, we have 60 plus confessions. That's a slam dunk, right? Well, when we start to hear about the circumstance of the confessions, the timeline of the confessions, and with that, the questions that raises about the reliability of the confessions, I think that is a less strong case. And even when I was talking with Nancy Grace, and she is pretty pro-prosecution, she saw the holes there too. And so if I was the prosecution, I'd be a little worried.
The prosecution came out with a lot of interesting pieces of evidence. They did, in fact, eventually play some of the audio from Richard Allen and video from behind bars. We've not heard it in the public, but people who have been there have relayed, of course, their accounts of it. They also played video of early interrogations, of early phone calls, of early interactions with Richard Allen. And from everything I've heard from anybody who has been in that courtroom, they sounded quite different from a alert, concerned Richard Allen to a very almost, you know, just robotic Richard Allen saying, I did it. I did it. Not, I didn't do this. I mean, and of course, the story changes from I had nothing to do with this to I did it. Tell everybody I did it. Just, you know, did the prosecution go too far? Did they play too much? They had a lot of evidence, but is that, in fact, going to kill their case because they're showing every side of Richard Allen here, including a psychotic one?
Well, you know, jurors are pretty smart and they're pretty perceptive. And so if you're showing two sides of the same person that are visibly contrastable, like you can see the visible differences in his mental state in the early interviews as compared to the later confession statements. I just think that a juror is going to put that together and say, hey, something is different between these two things. Did Richard Allen have a come to God moment and want to get something off his chest? Maybe that's what the prosecution is going to argue. But I think that there are some things in terms of how the confessions came out and the circumstances of them later that the jurors are really going to raise some eyebrows about.
You know, people do sometimes feign mental illness or what have you when they're behind bars. So it can be looked at as, well, they're crazy. There's something wrong with them. But the extremes to which Richard Allen went to, and including their own expert that they brought in, said he's not feigning this. I mean, he's literally eating his own feces. He's eating the Bible. He's running his head into a wall, all while intermittently saying, I did this in a monotone voice and being, you know, basically held captive with no sense of anything on the outside, and basically tortured by guards saying and taunting him while he's away. It's kind of understandable why he was in the state that he was. Do you think everybody is going to believe in that jury box that, yeah, he was in fact, he went psychotic because of what they were dealing with and what they were putting him through?
You know, it's tough. Anytime you have a confession that is so hard to overcome, even if it's under questionable circumstance, because, you know, the conventional thinking is, why would a person ever admit to something horribly heinous they didn't do? But when you talk about him being in solitary confinement for a long time, when you talk about him being feeling railroaded, feeling hopeless, feeling like, what else can I possibly do? It starts to make sense. Like, hey, I'm going to tell these people what I think they want to hear. Mm-hmm. Especially as my own mental health is visibly eroding. And so what does that confession really mean at that point?
Yeah. I want to talk about some of the evidence as well that the prosecution brought up. I'm very interested in how they're qualifying some of this evidence, specifically the state trooper that confirms the voice matched Alan. Now, that's his testimony. The voice matched Alan. Is that all it is? Is it just him going up there going, I listened to it. I think the voice matched Alan. We didn't hear anything else, as far as I'm aware, that there was like any sort of technology used to actually verify this. Anybody can just say, yeah, I think this is the guy. That's not any sort of verifiable proof. It's a guy making a claim. But that seems to be what they're sitting on, that it matches Alan's voice in a very inaudible way.
Yeah, I mean, it would be so much more compelling if they did some kind of like audio analysis and they said, hey, here are the pitches of Richard Allen's voice. Typically, you know, you could even do like an AI analysis of his interviews and say, hey, here's the ranges within which he speaks. Here's sort of his cadence. And is the audio from that video consistent with that? But no, it's just a dude up there saying, yeah, it kind of sounds like him.
And that's what amazes me. And that's just kind of like what they're resting on. I've never seen it where it's like this guy, and they're using it in a very technical way, though. It's a voice match. No, it's not. It's someone's opinion. It's a guess. There's nothing that says that. The ballistics is the other thing, and that's being argued on both sides. Of course, the prosecution saying, yeah, look at this. This unspent round really matches Alan's Sig Sauer pistol. The problem with that is it's not a very complete science. Could have been in another gun and, you know, matched that too pretty accurately if it's the same type of gun. How strong do you think that is playing to the jury, and the fact that the jury now knows that that bullet was there after you had 30, 40 officers trampling through the place, and then, oh, they found it then?
Oh, yeah. And you know, this type of ballistics analysis has never been that compelling to me, especially when you hear it in court. It's really a person getting up there and saying, hey, like some marks on the back of this bullet look like what I might expect them to look like from this gun. So it's got to be from this gun. But that's clearly, there's some holes there. And I am not at all persuaded by the ballistics analysis in this case.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of holes, there are just so many holes in the prosecution's case. Were you expecting that they were going to have something up their sleeve that we were just sitting here going, they must have? They're being so bold in front of this case and just denying everybody's motion. It was either they have nothing and they really want everything that could possibly show he's innocent not coming to light, other than what already is going to be there because our case is so weak, or they have something really amazing. It feels like it was the latter.
Yeah, you know, I really expected, especially in this type of an intimate, gruesome murder where there's a stabbing, you would expect some kind of DNA forensics. You would expect that if he brutally murdered and stabbed slit the throats of these two young girls, there would be some DNA transfer. There would be some hair that would get on to them, or some of their hair that would get onto him, or some kind of biological connection to what happened, and there is none.
Well, speaking of the hair, that was an interesting point, too. And I think what their explanation was spoke so much to how incompetent this investigation was. You had people just commenting, well, we thought it might be a family member. Everything's up for grabs in a murder investigation. There's no, well, we thought maybe. That just makes sense. No. What the hell is that? Where there was so much of that in this investigation, because they did find some hair on the girls, but they tested it far later. The initial reaction was, yeah, it's family. It's this or that on a body. I mean, what is that? Just inexperience? Is that just, you know, the podunk police department that just doesn't know what the hell they're doing? And they're just trying to do the best they can with what they have, including the limited knowledge and experience they have.
You know, in a high-level murder investigation, you've got to dot your I's and cross your T's, because these are questions that the defense is going to explore if they're good. They're questions the jury is going to have. And so the prosecution, you want to try to answer those questions in advance, anticipate what they're going to be, do the analysis, and have an explanation to give to the jury. Here, they didn't really. It was just kind of like, oh, like we eyeballed some stuff and like, oh, this makes sense to us. So find this guy guilty. That's not enough, man.
Yeah. Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
Let's be honest. Nothing kills the thrill of a good murder mystery like a commercial for laundry detergent. It's like someone slapping a closed sign on your favorite dive bar. But you're not here for that, are you? You're here for the good stuff. So ditch the ads and upgrade to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. With True Crime Today Premium Plus, you get your crime straight. No chaser. Commercial free with extended interviews and early access. It's like getting the bartender's special when the bar's already closed. Search for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe and drink it all in.